From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 43 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, I'll sit down for a chat with Dr. Francine Kaufman, the incoming chair of the National Diabetes Education Program. Wally Akinso has a story about a way to help African-American families make the kidney connection. We'll hear more about another good reason to cut back on your salt intake. And from a story aired earlier this year, Wally will tell us about the results of a study that may help improve the diagnosis and treatment of two debilitating childhood mental disorders. But first, imagine a new drug compound that can relieve pain without disrupting other functions in your body. It's not a fantasy, it's a fact, and it's one step closer to your pharmacy. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you have
claudication,
I don't have to tell you what the word means. You know, it's that muscular leg pain you get during walking caused by poor arterial circulation. If that's something you live with and you're 21 or older, log on to clinicaltrials.gov. If you're accepted, all study-related tests and procedures are provided for free. Call 866-999-1116 for more information. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Imagine pain relief with no disruption of your other functions. Relief for a toothache that doesn't numb your whole jaw. Anesthetic that doesn't result in an inability to move. A compound that affects pain neurons and only pain neurons. A study funded by the National Institutes of Health showed that such a compound is not just the stuff of dreams. A research team has identified a combination of two drugs that can selectively block pain-sensing neurons in rats without impairing movement or other sensations such as touch. The team, headed by Dr. Clifford J. Wolf of Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Bruce Bean of Harvard Medical School, tested a combination of capsaicin, the substance that makes chili peppers hot, and a drug called QX314 on neurons in a petri dish, and they determined that it blocked pain-sensing neurons without affecting other nerve cells. The compound was then tested on rats, which then showed no signs of pain and were able to move and behave normally.
It's a pretty clever approach that they took, and we were certainly really excited about the outcome in the animal studies and the potential sort of long-term outlook for human studies.
That was Dr. Linda Porter, program officer for the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, which, along with the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research and the National Institute of General Medical Sciences, funded the study. Despite the hopeful results, Dr. Porter says there's much more studying to be done before such a pain-relieving compound could be made available to human patients.
Well, I assume the next step that they'll take is to begin to look more carefully at what kind of dosing that would have to be used in humans, how long-term the effects might be. So in the animal studies that they've done, the pain relief lasts for 2 or 3 or maybe more hours. You know, questions with toxicity, with irritation, the mode of delivery. We're very excited about it. And, you know, we're hoping that this is something that will move along pretty quickly. The studies in the animals are looking to be very promising, and so we're keeping our fingers crossed that this will move.
One problem with the current compound, as you might expect given its chili pepper origin, capsaicin tends to cause a burning sensation when first administered. Scientists will search for alternatives to capsaicin that do the same thing without causing the burning sensation. They'll also look for ways to prolong the pain relief and hope to eventually develop pills that will stop the pain signals without requiring injections. The study appeared in the October 4th edition of Nature. Now, Now, Wally Akinzo has this story, first aired earlier this year, about a study that could lead to improvements in the care of some serious childhood mental conditions.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse has unveiled its first consumer publication dedicated to explain the science of addiction. The 30-page full-color booklet, Drugs, Brains, and Behavior, The Science of Addiction, explains in layman's terms how science has revolutionized the understanding of drug addiction as a brain disease that affects behavior. Dr. Timothy Condon, NIDA's deputy director, said this new publication will help reduce the stigma attached to addictive disorders.
Well, this booklet explains the scientific research that NIDA has supported over the last 20 or 30 years and how this research has really revolutionized our understanding of drug addiction, essentially as a brain disease that results in compulsive behavior.
The new publication was introduced during a press briefing for the upcoming HBO documentary called Addiction. Dr. Condon said the timing was fortunate.
This is very fortuitous that it's coming out around the same time as the HBO documentary that NIDA's been a part of. We think this will be a very important adjunct to information for the public, the lay audience, to help them understand the science behind the disease of addiction.
The 90-minute documentary airs Thursday, March 15th. It was produced in partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the National Institute on Drug Abuse and Alcoholism, and NIDA, and will explore many elements of drug and alcohol addiction through the eyes of those who are addicted and the experts working to better understand and treat this disease. If you're interested in a copy of the booklet, visit www.drugabuse.gov. This is Wally Akinzo at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, I'll sit down for a chat with Dr. Francine Kaufman, the incoming chair of the National Diabetes Education Program. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
Where will you find the future of science? Right here with us.
The students of today are the scientists of tomorrow. Will we be ready?
We are the future doctors and nurses, lab technicians, and scientists. We are the future of science.
Support science education in your local schools.
The scientists of tomorrow need your support today.
Brought to you by the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Service.
Welcome back to NIH Research Radio. Our guest in the studio, Dr. Francine Kaufman. She's the head of the Center for Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolism at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, and is the chair-elect for the National Diabetes Education Program. Welcome to NIH Research Radio.
Thank you.
We're here to talk about many things, actually. The World Diabetes Day coming up in the month of November. November 14th, as a matter of fact. The purpose of World Diabetes Day is to raise the awareness of the impact of diabetes on the lives of children and adolescents worldwide. And I guess that's a good place to start as any. What is the impact of diabetes on our kids?
Well, there are more and more people, certainly adults, developing diabetes across the globe. This is not about the developed world as much anymore. This is occurring in the developing world as well. And we're really talking in this case about type 2 diabetes, having to do with genes and environments coming into collision. So I just finished actually going around the world for Discovery Health, making a documentary. We went to India, Brazil, South Africa, and there are more and more people who are overweight and developing type 2 diabetes there, and more children involved in addition.
See, now here I was under the impression that type 2 diabetes was a relatively rare phenomenon among kids.
Well, type 2 diabetes is still relatively rare among children, and we have wonderful data in the United States from the SEARCH trial that really shows that the predominant form of diabetes for children under the age of 10 is almost exclusively type 1. But over that age, so 11 to 19, there are more and more teens developing type 2 diabetes, particularly Native American, Hispanic and African American and Asian American teenagers in this country. And we're seeing maybe not an epidemic, but certainly an increase, a significant increase. We don't know where this might top out, and we have to be aware that this is something new for children.
Well, what's causing this uptick in type 2 diabetes among our kids?
Well, it's really mirroring the childhood obesity epidemic, which is mirroring, of course, the overall obesity epidemic in the country and in the world. And we're watching our children spend more time in front of a screen, less time in physical activity, and certainly having access to the kinds of foods and the quantities that aren't healthy. And we've got to get our kids back to a healthy lifestyle.
So how do we do that? Is it just education? Is it parental enforcement? Because parents aren't necessarily eating that well either.
I get a lot of questions of how do I make my children eat better? And the first thing I always say is, well,
tell them to.
Well, no, you do it first. You make your house a healthy environment and the option, particularly if you do it early enough, that will become their habits. That will become what they're used to. And that will become, hopefully, what they want to do. So you can't have your children do something that you're not doing. So parents have to mirror good eating as well as good physical activity.
So if you're pounding down the candy bars, you're not going to be able to successfully talk your child into enjoying a tasty, healthy carrot, for instance.
I think that's probably true. So, and if you tell them, go out and be physically active, and you're sitting in front of the television, that's not going to necessarily resonate either. So if you want them to be physically active, do physical activities as a family. Then, of course, we've got the whole school idea.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up because kids spend so much time in a school setting and they're away from home all that time. They're kind of out of the influence of their parents. What can we do in the school setting to make kids less likely to come down with type 2 diabetes?
Well, I think that, you know, the overall concept is we will make school a healthy environment so that the healthy options are there. It's not just options, but physical activity promoted as an important activity in addition to all the academics. So one of the things that is going on is the Healthy Trial, an NIH-funded trial that will look at over 6,000 middle school students from 6th through 8th grade in 42 schools in 7 sites across the country, and half of those schools will have fundamentally changed food services, PE programs, kind of what goes on as far as health messaging, outreach to families. 2 more years, we'll find out whether that has a significant impact on children's health.
So keeping the kids active in school, getting rid of the junk that's in the snack machines and that sometimes is served at the lunch counters, that's a key toward controlling diabetes in our youngsters.
Well, that's a presumptive key, and then this healthy trial will give us the evidence whether that makes a difference, and the outcomes will be looking at risk factors for type 2 diabetes.
Well, tell us about this search study that's going to be going on here.
Well, the search trial is part of it's almost ended of looking at incident and prevalent cases of diabetes in the country and then looking at some other risk factors. So I think one of the most impressive things that's come out of search is the number of children with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes who are at risk for cardiovascular disease. So in the type 1 population, about 14% of these children already have 2 or more cardiovascular disease risk factors. And in the type 2 population, it was 92% of them.
Wow.
So it's not just diabetes. It's looking at diabetes as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and realizing that this begins in childhood.
All right. Now, we're talking a lot about preventing diabetes among our kids. But in the cases where the kids do come down with it, what are some of the questions parents should ask of their health care providers about their child's diabetes?
Well, the National Diabetes Education Program has put forth kind of a tip sheet of questions to ask at the time of diagnosis. I will tell you, as a clinician, once your 2-year-old or your 3-year-old is diagnosed with diabetes, a lot of these parents are just so overwhelmed and so emotional that it takes them a while to wade through, what do I really need to find out?
Right.
So this tip sheet will enable them to know, well, you know, I know this has been a tremendous shock to me, my family, and my child, but in addition, these are critical things I need to find out between me and my health care provider.
Right. It's terrible news, but now you have, as a parent, to deal with it.
Right. And you have to take the driver's seat in some way. You have to find out, you know, what are my treatment options? What are going to happen in the long term? What's the relationship I'm going to have with this diabetes center and my expectations so that you can really be in control going forward?
Now, you mentioned the tip sheet. The National Diabetes Education Program has several free resources that are available for children, for adolescents, for their parents, for their schools. Could you touch on some of those?
Yeah, there's a number of wonderful, wonderful sheets. Probably the most exciting ones are for tip sheets for children themselves, particularly about type 2 diabetes.
Right.
What do I do about my type 2 diabetes? How can I prevent it? Good eating, good activity. Really done in a kid-friendly way. I don't think it's a bunch of grown-ups trying to say this is what we want you to learn, but we've done and involved a lot of children in helping us be sure that these are the right message and the wording that we use really resonates with teens and children.
So how can mom and dad, educators, and maybe even interested kids get in touch with the National Diabetes Education Program?
Well, the National Diabetes Education Program has all of these available for the public.
Right.
And I, as a clinician, tell my families all the time when they're diagnosed, and as we're going forward, to look for resources, and NDEP, National Diabetes Education Program, is probably the best resource there is. It has for providers, it has for children, it has for families, and you can access that at www.yourdiabetesinfo.org.
That's all one word, yourdiabetesinfo.org, right? All right, we're talking to Dr. Francine Kaufman, and before we wrap things up, anything else you want to add?
Well, just that there's a lot we can all do to prevent diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, and once you get diabetes, there's a lot of information you need. There's a lot of information you can obtain through the NDEP website so that you can be in control going forward and optimize your child's health.
Dr. Francine Kaufman, our guest today on NIH Research Radio. She's the head of the Center for Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolism at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. And you'll be hearing a lot more of her as the chair-elect of the National Diabetes Education Program. Thanks for being our guest with us today on NIH Research Radio.
Thank you.
For more information about the National Diabetes Education Program, visit the website www.yourdiabetesinfo.org or call the toll-free hotline at 1-888-693-NDEP. That's 888-693-6337. When we come back, Wally Akinso has a story about an educational brochure tailored especially for African Americans. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
With African Americans suffering from kidney diseases more than any other segment of the population, one institute at the NIH is taking the initiative in getting out the word. Wally Akinso has more.
The National Kidney Disease Education Program has created an educational brochure tailored specifically for African Americans at risk for kidney disease. The brochure, Kidney Disease, What African Americans Need to Know, explains the connection between diabetes, high blood pressure, and kidney disease, and encourages those at risk to talk to their healthcare providers about getting tested. African Americans are disproportionately affected by kidney failure, due in part to higher rates of diabetes and high blood pressure, the two leading causes of kidney failure. Dr. Andrew Narva, director of the NKDEP, talks about what the brochure has to offer.
The brochure explains the reasons for being screened, who's at risk, which includes people with diabetes, high blood pressure, family member with kidney disease, or heart disease. And it explains how screening is done, which includes two relatively simple tests, a blood test and a urine test.
In developing the brochure, NKDEP worked with healthcare professionals who routinely care for African American patients at risk for kidney disease. The NKDEP is an initiative of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. For more information about the brochure and other NKDEP materials, visit www.nkdep.nih.gov or call 1-866-454-3639. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
You've heard all about the many benefits of reducing your sodium intake, preventing high blood pressure leading the list. Now, if you needed yet another reason to cut back on salt, new data from a clinical trial from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute shows that people with pre-hypertension who reduce their sodium intake by 25 to 35% had a 25% lower risk of total cardiovascular disease over the 10 to 15 years during which they cut back on salt. Dr. Jeffrey Cutler, NHLBI Project Officer of the Trials of Hypertension Prevention Program, also known as TOHP, said it's reasonable to assume that the reduction in heart disease risk goes hand in hand with the reduced risk of high blood pressure that results when a person reduces his or her sodium intake.
That's the logical interpretation. There are data both from animal studies and, you know, human population studies that reducing sodium might have some benefits separable from its effect on blood pressure, but most likely the major chain of causation is through its effect on blood pressure.
Two of these TOHP trials were conducted in 10 clinical sites, one from 1987 to 1990, the other from 1990 to 1995, with follow-up for 10 to 15 years after each trial. This new follow-up data shows that the groups who reduced their sodium intake also had lower mortality from cardiovascular disease. Dr. Cutler said the news may even be better than it seems at first blush.
The levels attained in these randomized trials conducted in the late 1980s and early 1990s were substantial, but they were not even at the level what the guidelines recommended at that time. In fact, for much of the population, the guidelines are now recommending lower levels, in part because of another study that NHLBI sponsored, the DASH sodium study, which showed that for a given amount of salt reduction, the blood pressure reduction is greater in the lower range level than at the higher range level. So we're operating in TOHP for the most part in the range above the area where you get the maximum benefit. So it is very likely that this study underestimates the potential public health benefit.
The new data has been published online by the British Medical Journal. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, November 2nd, when episode 44 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the Health Star Radio Network, and online at www.federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. That email address is ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, that email address is ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.